Today's episode is sponsored by AARP. Social Security is the most important issue that voters over 50 will be considering in Florida this fall, according to a new poll by Politico and AARP. Will this voting block decide the 2018 midterms? Visit politico.com/thedeciders to learn more.
Everyone all set? Okay. All right, let's do it. Here we go. Hello, listeners, and welcome to another edition of Politico's Nerdcast. I'm Scott Bland, your host. This week on the show, what comes next after Supreme Court Justice Anthony Kennedy announced his retirement this week? Plus, a closer look at the biggest primary upset of 2018 so far with Congressman Joe Crowley, the number 4 House Democrat, going down in a primary to 28-year-old Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez in New York City. We will talk about all that in great depth in the second segment. A reminder to our listeners to subscribe to the Nerdcast, rate us, and write a review, and stay tuned to the end of the show for a contribution from one of the Nerdcast's biggest fans. One more note before we begin, we are taping this a little bit before noon Eastern on Thursday, June 28th, so it's all up to date as of then. As of right now, only one Supreme Court justice has retired so far this week. All right, let's get started. I want to welcome our guests. We have senior politics editor Charlie Mattesian. Good to see you, Charlie.
Hi, Scott.
Are you still watching the World Cup over there on your monitor while this is going on?
No comment.
We have White House reporter Nancy Cook back in the studio. Hi, Nancy.
Thanks for having me.
And, of course, Josh Gerstein, who covers the Supreme Court, among many other things, for Politico. Hi, Josh.
Hey, good to be here.
Now, the reason Josh is here is the reason for our first segment. Our first data point is 30. That is 30 years that Anthony Kennedy has been a Supreme Court justice, but he's cutting that short this summer. He announced on Wednesday that he's going to be retiring.
Good afternoon. We're coming to you with major breaking news from the world of politics. Supreme Court Justice Anthony M. Kennedy announcing he will retire. This leaves a major opening.
Josh, kick us off here. Obviously, the retirement of a Supreme Court justice is a huge earthquake politically. You've done some reporting on how the White House goes into the process of replacing a justice. When I say the White House, I mean both generally in the past and then also how this White House goes about replacing Supreme Court justice. So tell us a little bit about the process here.
So most White Houses have tend to play this very close to the vest. They would quietly have a couple members of the White House counsel's office gather information on potential nominees and compile it and do this behind the scenes. Things have played out a little differently under Trump. Folks may remember back during the campaign, candidate Trump released not just one, but two lists of potential Supreme Court nominees. You would think they would have been drafted by his immediate advisors or staff, but in fact, they were pretty open about the fact that they outsourced this process to a couple of conservative groups, the Federalist Society, which is a conservative legal organization of many of the leading lights on the right in the legal movement. And then also the Heritage Foundation played a role in putting those lists together. And Trump basically pledged he'd pick somebody off that list, which kind of curtailed the normal process somewhat. And then last year, obviously, you had Neil Gorsuch selected to take Scalia's seat. But then you had Trump late in the year, I believe on the same day as another Federalist Society meeting, put out 5 more names of people that he was considering. So at least in theory, we have the names on the table, and it becomes then a question of sort of trying to handicap which of those may be filler, which of them may be things that the president is interested in having on the list, and who is actually a serious contender for getting the nomination.
Nancy, you've done a lot of reporting on this in the past, how big a role this list of Supreme Court justices played in Trump's election in 2016 and in kind of keeping bits of the conservative coalition that might otherwise have crumbled away from some of the stuff that Trump has done in line because he's so in sync with them. I mean, he's outsourced the whole question of these big judicial appointments to them.
Yeah, there was a feeling during the campaign before he put out this list and also before he picked Vice President Mike Pence. A lot of conservative groups were suspicious of Trump. You know, he was a New Yorker. I think he had espoused some pro-choice views in the past when he lived in New York. And so people were really suspicious. And then when he put out these lists, that really mobilized a lot of the anti-abortion groups to get behind him, a lot of conservative groups. And that gave people a real sense of comfort. You know, I talked to some folks in the White House this morning before coming here, and I feel like this, the idea of appointing another Supreme Court justice, one person described it to me, has lit up the whole conservative movement. And what's interesting to me is that, you know, heading into the midterms, there was a lot of different factions in the White House sort of pushing what policy message they should be talking about, whether it was the economy or opioid stuff or immigration. Now I feel like, you know, less than 24 hours after this announcement that Kennedy is retiring, suddenly, just through luck and timing, the whole White House and Republican apparatus has been totally mobilized behind this Supreme Court justice pick as the thing that they're going to talk about this summer. And groups that before may have been spending money, again, to promote the tax bill, you know, are now redirecting that money to supporting whoever gets nominated. And there's just like a tremendous amount of excitement. And I would say it really unites, you know, a pretty diverse coalition of Republicans, you know, sort of the establishment people, the business people, the conservatives, the evangelicals, around a single goal, just as much as it also simultaneously energizes the left.
It's really interesting, the point about kind of the unification that we were just talking about. A great case in point would be the Koch network, right?
Absolutely.
Which has been railing on the White House over tariffs for weeks now, but is getting ready to make a big multi-million dollar push to help whoever it is that they nominate.
Yeah, the Koch brothers and the Americans for Prosperity, which is one of their sort of grassroots groups, was furious that the tariffs would sort of cancel out the tax bill. And now I feel like all has been forgotten. We don't know exactly how much they're going to spend. I'm trying to track down that figure today. But, you know, that group, the Federalist Society, the Judicial Crisis Network, all these conservative groups are really, you know, mobilizing very quickly, in fact.
And it came in on the heels of what had been just an atrocious news period for the White House with the family separation situation and the immigration, where you have, again, kind of a divide among Republicans about how they feel about those issues. Some of them are with Trump on a very, very strong border anti-immigration policy, but a lot of the more Koch libertarian
and
folks,
the business groups, too.
Right. Many of the Koch-funded groups are, in fact, more in favor of an open border type policy, and they definitely would not have been supportive of what Trump has been up to in the last couple of weeks on this whole issue of cracking down on immigration and then the family separation policy.
Josh, I want to jump back into the what the Supreme Court has been up to for the last few weeks in a second. But first, Charlie, to Nancy's point about the politics of this coming up in the summer before a midterm year, it's really interesting. I was kind of wrestling in the office yesterday with thinking through just how this affects the political landscape. On the one hand, we know, having just seen in 2016 how the Republican Party and the conservative movement can unify around Trump and you know, new Supreme Court justice, conservative judicial picks. On the other hand, we're also seeing a lot, like an explosion of energy on the left right away about the possibility that a new justice replacing Kennedy could overturn Roe v. Wade. And so there's a lot of kind of cross pressures here.
I think it's manna from heaven for the Republican Party. They couldn't have gotten better news given how awful the optics of the migrant family separations have been, given how splintered and fractured that party is. This is the one thing that they all agree on in the Trump era, meaning whether it's a never Trumper, whether it's a hold your nose and support the president crew, or whether it's the MAGA crew, all of them unite on the issue of Supreme Court nominations. I mean, what is the one thing that people always cite about the Trump era when you talk about them? The Gorsuch nomination. I mean, if you were to get Mitch McConnell privately, that's what he's going to tell you. Like, yeah, how do you live with it? How can you deal with the chaos of this administration? Well, Supreme Court nomination.
And there's a hashtag, right, Charlie? But Gorsuch is the hashtag, right? To almost responding to almost any criticism of things Trump has done or things folks find to be stupid or appalling, people say, well, but Gorsuch.
It's exactly true. And here's the thing. Democrats can't get any more amped up. You know, the energy at the grassroots is through the roof. You see that in all the polling. Republicans, though, they're still a little more, you know, they're amped up, but not to the degree Democrats are.
That's interesting.
And so this is the one thing they needed to get the base focused on 2018. And I think if I was a Republican consultant or if I was a Republican on that ballot running, I would be thrilled.
It sure seems like they are right away. I'm not sure if I totally agree with you that Democrats couldn't possibly get more amped up than they already are, because I'm not sure if they're, if you can put a ceiling on that.
Maybe.
But.
Oh, one thing I forgot that I wanted to mention. The other part of this that's great for Republicans is it puts the squeeze on red state Senate Democrats.
Right.
Who gets screwed by this? It is the Manchins, the Heitkamps, the Joe Donnellys. It's the Bob Caseys of the world. All of these Senate Democrats who are in states that Trump won, where there are strong pro-life movements, where this is going to be a really tough vote.
Well, and in fact, to that point, you know, this morning the White House, you know, they have these lists of, they have surrogate lists that they send out, you know, talking points to. This morning, you know, around 10, surrogate lists got, you know, a whole, you know, multi-part email all about Senate Democrats and how they're going to target them. And I also spoke this morning to someone from SBA List, which is a, you know, conservative anti-abortion group. They already have people on the ground in a lot of these states that Trump carried in 2016, which have red state Democrats up for re-election this year. And they're putting even more people on the ground. And that's sort of their focus. So I think that's going to be a key part of the White House strategy, turnout strategy for the midterms.
Interesting. Josh, let's jump back into the court and what it's been up to for the last week or so leading up to Kennedy's retirement. I mean, obviously the left is not thrilled to see him go, because there was always this hope that he would end up being with them on some of the big cases here or there. But over the past week, we've seen a number of pretty important decisions where Kennedy was siding with the four kind of regular conservative justices against the four liberal justices.
Well, that's right, Scott. The hope, that has been a hope, but this year, this term, it was nothing more than that. In fact, there was no time that Kennedy aligned with the four liberals to do a 5-4 decision.
Really?
So his reputation as the swing voter on the court, we did a piece saying, you know, this swing vote on the court just, you know, hasn't swung this term.
Okay, Josh, who are some of the names floating around here as the potential Kennedy replacements? Like you said, it seems like pretty much a guarantee that it's going to be more conservative than Kennedy, but there are a number of options floating around out there. Obviously, Trump has put out this public list, which is not something previous presidents have done, but even within that, there are a few kind of thoughts percolating about who might be a favorite on there.
Right. So people are thinking that one of the main contenders could be a fellow by the name of Brett Kavanaugh, who's a judge on the D.C. Circuit. He was a lawyer in the White House counsel's office under George W. Bush. He's a very affable fellow. I've seen him on the bench. He tries to build consensus. There was recently a big showdown over abortion rights for immigrant minors who are in U.S. custody. And what he tried to do there was try to fashion something where these teenage girls could be released from custody and get their abortion without the involvement of the government. His liberal colleagues kind of thwarted him on that, and he seemed very upset by it. It seemed like an almost deliberate effort to try to find some kind of middle ground, and he seemed sort of angered and hurt by the fact that he wasn't allowed to go forward with that compromise. But you can also see that, obviously, as someone trying to set the stage for a potential Supreme Court nomination hearing, where you would see this discussed as indication of his reasonableness. There's also a Sixth Circuit Appeals Court judge by the name of Ray Kethledge, who is apparently very well respected by Leonard Leo, who's the head of the Federalist Society, and also Don McGahn, the White House counsel. We also have the question out there of whether Trump might, for various reasons, like some of the ones Charlie was talking about, with a number of votes of women senators in play, might look to a woman. He may be passed over picking a woman the last time around. So you have Joan Larson, who's on the Sixth Circuit. You also have Amy Barrett, who had a very contentious nomination for the Seventh Circuit, Allison Eade. There are a bunch of different names that I think are at the top of the list. And I do think, though, that picking a woman would be a very interesting choice, because you have abortion rights so likely to be one of the most contentious issues in this nomination. You have senators like Susan Collins, Heidi Heitkamp, Lisa Murkowski, potentially holding the balance here, and to put them in a situation where they would be voting against a woman could be an awkward situation. It could also undercut efforts to use this issue, I think, as an electoral issue at the polls.
Josh, I have to ask this question because I think there's a lot of information out there and a lot of people are probably wondering this. What is the likelihood that Trump names some like a Judge Judy or a Gene Pirro character? Mm-hmm.
I think it's unlikely. Remember, we've had Don Willett, who is known as like the tweeting judge on the list for some time.
He's like an accomplished guy, right? An accomplished scholar. Like I'm talking about, you know.
You're talking about a complete talk show host. Figure. I think it's unlikely, just because for the reasons we discussed, like Republicans are in control of the Senate, but they have only a very small margin there, and I don't think it would be smart to provoke somebody like Susan Collins or Murkowski by putting up somebody who's a talk show host. I think it might be something that would resonate with Trump, or he might think was a great play. But I do think that ultimately his people would talk him out of it. I mean, they basically did last time. So they picked Gorsuch, who was a very serious person. And I don't think it's likely that whatever Trump's inclinations are, that his people would allow him to take such a potentially significant choice and handle it in that kind of a fashion when you're talking about somebody that could be on the court for 30 years to come.
Also, last time, you know, if this follows the same pattern, you know, last time Don McGahn, who's the top White House attorney, who we thought may leave this summer, but I think will definitely stick around for this, and Leonard Leo, who's a very influential leader, one of the leaders of the Federalist Society, you know, they were really involved in kind of like winnowing down that list and then basically handed that list to Trump of like four or five candidates. And then Trump interviewed those. I think Pence was in the room as well. So I feel like that would avoid, you know, sort of a TV personality pick. Although it was interesting because Donald Trump Jr. yesterday was expressing some, he was, you know, tweeting, oh, it would be great to hire Judge Jeanine. So we'll see.
All right. We will see what happens. It's going to be happening quickly. The White House and the Senate, Majority Leader Mitch McConnell have said that they want to get this done through, you know, the summer and fall, get it done in relatively rapid order. So we're just going to have to wait and see who they pick and how those confirmation hearings go. Josh, thank you so much for talking us through that.
Hey, happy to do it.
And Nancy, thank you as well.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Today's episode is sponsored by AARP. America's largest retirement community is advertised as Florida's friendliest hometown. It was created to evoke a bygone era of traditional values when Americans knew their neighbors, respected their elders, and followed the rules. It is this sort of senior voter that is influencing U.S. elections and is featured in the first installment of Politico Magazine's new series, The Deciders. Visit politico.com/thedeciders to learn more. And check back each month for the latest issue.
All right, we're going to move on to our next data point, which is 28. That is the age, 28 years old, of Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. And she is the progressive Democrat who beat Congressman Joe Crowley in a primary in New York earlier this week. He had been in that office since 1999. Not only was he the 10-term incumbent, he was the chairman of the Queens County Democratic Party. So this is a guy who was rising in stature in Washington. He was number four House Democrat. There was talk of him as a potential future speaker. He was the chairman of the party machine back home, although as we'll discuss, it was a little less than machine-like on Tuesday night. And he's gone. He lost his primary. He's going to be leaving Congress at the end of this year, and he's going to be replaced by Ocasio-Cortez. So here to talk about it, we have on the line from the Capitol, we have Heather Cagle, who covers congressional Democrats for Politico. Hi, Heather.
Hi, how are you?
Good, good. And on Skype from Politico New York, we have Gloria Pazmino. Hi, Gloria.
Hi, everyone.
Thank you so much for joining us. So let's start with you, Gloria. Tell us about Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. Tell us about where she came from and how she did this.
Women like me aren't supposed to run for office. I wasn't born to a wealthy or powerful family. Mother from Puerto Rico, dad from the South Bronx.
I was born. Yeah, so this is a young woman, as you said, 28 years old, who got her start not long ago as a Bernie Sanders organizer. She was over at Standing Rock demonstrations not too long ago. And after that experience, there was a group of political activists that were looking to recruit new candidates who reached out to her. Less than a year ago, she was working as a waitress in a restaurant to help support her family. She has worked in education before, and she got recruited to run this campaign with, I really cannot overstate the odds that were against her. This is someone, as you said, who's been in office for 10 terms, incumbent candidate, a huge fundraiser for the party on the national stage, someone who no one thought would be able to lose his seat. She ran a very interesting campaign, very little money, but she had an army of volunteers behind her. They marshaled a giant social media and digital presence that I think got her a lot of attention and a lot of pickup. And they really ran this campaign as they say, all politics is local, and her campaign really pounded the pavement in Queens and the Bronx, knocking on doors, talking to people, and getting those votes, something that Joe Crowley had never had to do before since his time in office, because in the 14 years he's been there, he'd never faced a primary challenger.
Right. Gloria, how much of this do you think, from your observations, you know, during the race and from talking to people after, how much do you think Ocasio-Cortez's victory owed to her coming at Crowley from the left as a democratic socialist and kind of attacking his corporate ties, coming at him from the left on some issues? And how much do you think she owes it to kind of the demographic and generational argument she made as someone of Puerto Rican descent running in a 50% Latino district against, you know, one of the very few white members of Congress representing a district that non-white?
So, you know, this is an interesting question, and I think the short answer is that I think there is a good mixture of both of those elements.
I think that's the right answer in politics, honestly. Everyone always wants to choose one, but I think that's usually the right one.
That's really, and I've had some discussions with folks in the last couple of days about this, who, because some people want to chalk up the race to demographic shifts in the district, and that's true. But demographic shifts aren't only representative of racial groups or ethnic groups. There has been huge change in Queens and the Bronx over the last couple of years. But that doesn't just means that that doesn't only mean that immigrants and people of color are becoming involved. It also means that young white professionals are moving into these neighborhoods. They want to be politically active. They want to do something post Donald Trump. And I think she spoke to that. So when you combine that with her points about Crowley being someone who took money from super PACs, somebody who was part of the status quo, someone who for 14 years hasn't kept a home in the district, hasn't noticed the changes happening literally beneath his feet. That makes a really compelling argument for anyone who's been in that community in the last 10 years and who might be a little bit of a newcomer and who want to see something new. So I think it was a kind of a perfect combination of those two elements that really helped her mount that campaign. The racial aspect of this, I think, has to be acknowledged because the district is changing, and I think Crowley was trying to market himself, to use that word, as a, you know, the new face of the Democratic Party, the progressive, someone who could possibly lead the Dems, and I think people were looking at that and saying, you know what, I'm not sure that a white guy in his mid-50s is what the party needs right now.
And Ocasio-Cortez actually made that argument explicitly, too, when she was campaigning. Heather, I want to bring you in here. How did this surprising result land in Congress? You've done some great reporting in recent months about Crowley's stature rising in Washington, and you know, just as his fall was coming at home. And now, obviously, you know, all that groundwork is going to come to nothing with him leaving Congress.
Yeah, you know, I don't want to exaggerate here, and I'm not at all, but this loss landed like a bomb in the Democratic caucus on Tuesday night. I was texting with members and leadership aides, and the response I kept getting back was everyone was just so stunned. We're stunned. We're shocked. We can't believe it. And then I talked to some members the day after on Wednesday, and they were telling me, you know, Crowley had been on the floor the night before the primary on Monday night, and a lot of members were shocked by that because normally if you have a primary challenger, you're back home in your district, you know, shaking hands and knocking on doors and stuff like that. And he wasn't. He was here voting, and he kept telling people late last week, and on Monday he's like, no, we got it. Don't worry about it. It's not a big deal. And everyone believed him, and I think Crowley believed him himself, you know. And so when he lost on Tuesday night, I mean, no one knew what to do with themselves. And then we wake up Wednesday morning, and the leadership jockeying and what this means for November is already in full force, you know, and kicked off at rapid speed. So that's kind of where we are now, is what does his loss mean for the potential leadership, the Democratic ranks after the November election?
And this all goes back to kind of this growing sense that it might be time for a change from Nancy Pelosi at the top of that Democratic leadership structure. Not to mention Steny Hoyer as her number two and James Clyburn as the number three, right? There's this sense that, that there's it's time for generational change there too. And Crowley had started to absorb a lot of that that feeling, but obviously they're going to have to look somewhere else now.
Yeah, and you know, so Pelosi and Hoyer and Clyburn, they're all in their late 70s, 78, 79. They've all been in power for more than a decade. Pelosi and Hoyer have been in power for 16 years. And so the caucus has been grumbling about change for a while, but it's really started to come to a head as we've, you know, the party's embraced this anti-establishment, progressive, you know, upending the old order kind of mood. And Crowley, for a lot of members, was in the best position. He may not have been the best fit for everyone because he was an Irish white guy from New York, you know, and he doesn't necessarily represent or typify the diversity of the party and what's kind of leading this change. But he was in leadership. He was 20 years younger than the top three. And so for a lot of members in the caucus, they saw him as the best opportunity to uproot the old guard. And now that's completely gone, and there is no other front runner to take out Pelosi, at least right now.
Interesting. We'll have to, I mean, I'm sure we will be monitoring who tries to grab that mantle over the next few months. Gloria, as Washington Democrats were coming to grips with this, you had a front row seat on Tuesday to how Crowley himself and his closest supporters and aides were coming to grips with this. You were at his event as they were all watching these stunning numbers roll in. Can you unpack the scene for us a little bit?
Yes. So this is very interesting to watch. Crowley had his campaign, his election watch party at a restaurant in the Jackson Heights section of Queens, which is a predominantly Latino neighborhood. And I got there and people were starting to file in. You know, it felt like your normal election night for an incumbent. People were happy. The open bar was buzzing. You know, the band was setting up. The T-shirts were being distributed. And people seemed in a, you know, everybody seemed confident up until the polls here in New York closed at 9. And I would say it was within those first 15 minutes after 9 o'clock that that people, you could sense that some fear was starting to set in. And what was interesting about this place, you know, usually campaign parties are held at a place where you can have a TV so you can watch everything. This place did not have a screen. So you had a room filled with people with their faces just buried in their phones, watching their returns come in. And I mentioned this on election night. Crowley's known for his love of music, and he's known to pick up a guitar and put on a show. And his band was there that night, and the band never started playing. And as soon as these results, as soon as it became clear that this was not going in the right direction, it just got quieter and quieter. And then, you know, he showed up a little bit after 9 o'clock.
He was greeted with a lot of applause. You know, there was a lot of hugging. There was a lot of, "I'm sorry, Joe." I remember this line very clearly of what he said as he was walking in, and, you know, people were clapping, slapping him on the back. He said, "Sometimes life just throws you a curveball." He called himself a happy warrior, and he went in, he picked up his guitar, and as he had done many other times, just started singing. And, you know, I saw people in tears watching him play that guitar and watching him give his concession speech. I thought it was quite graceful. He, you know, he vowed to support Ocasio-Cortez. He had done so. He had promised to do that earlier in the race. He wished her nothing but the best. And, you know, there wasn't the sense that he was angry or bitter, but I have to imagine that his allies and everyone in his inner circle are still processing this loss.
It certainly seems that way. And, you know, given that they didn't see it coming, I can't imagine they entirely know what to make of it yet. And it's probably going to take some time studying the returns to do so. Charlie, just in terms of the bigger picture here and looking at this from the lens of the National Democratic Party and everything it's going through right now, you know, we talked a little bit about the ways in which this district is unique, but it's not so unique that you can't draw lessons from it that people are going to be thinking about in other primaries in 2018, coming up on the presidential race in 2020, just thinking about the future of the party in general. What did you take away from this result?
Yeah, I think it's unique in the sense that Gloria mentioned, which is it's not just diverse. It is, you know, arguably the most diverse congressional district in the United States. So that's fairly unique compared to, you know, the body of other districts. But I think what we see, what we can learn from that race is the generational conflict within the Democratic Party. I mean, there's some ideological conflict there in that Ocasio-Cortez was, you know, clearly from the progressive wing of the party, and she was, farther out there than most challengers. But what I found really interesting was the generational conflict. She was hitting him partly as an old white guy in a highly diverse district, but also the fact that he'd been in there for so long. He's a member of Democratic House leadership that is very advanced in age. I mean, Ocasio-Cortez was born, or Nancy Pelosi was in Congress already when Ocasio-Cortez was born. And so you're seeing challenges like this a lot, particularly in the big cities where you've got all these young, mostly millennials, but you've got lots of folks who were energized by Bernie Sanders or for another progressive cause that are jumping into the political arena and challenging these old-time incumbents. A perfect example is this is happening in the Boston area with Mike Capuano, where the dynamic is very similar. Older white ethnic guy has held the seat for a long time, and the challenger is a young woman of color who's arguing, "Hey, is this really the right person for our party to be leading us in this congressional district?"
Heather, I want to give you the last word here. What was the reaction on kind of that political side of the equation, in addition to the future of the Democratic caucus and leadership in the House, but on the political side from all these House Democrats watching this happening? You know, were some of them maybe thinking, "It's like, hey, maybe I should spend a little bit more time walking the blocks next time I'm home this weekend or next?" Or
yeah, you know, it's funny you bring that up. I was talking to a leadership aide who's on the floor, and I was talking to him yesterday, and he said on the House floor during votes on Wednesday, all of the members kept saying, "We need to go home. We need to get out of here." Even the ones that don't have primary challengers, I mean, they were just so rattled by it. And then Crowley wasn't in the House on Wednesday, but he came back on Thursday, and he couldn't move, you know, one foot without getting a hug. Even Republicans like Steve Scalise came over and gave him a big hug. His staff is all crying. I mean, it's a very emotional thing for the members because Crowley was very well liked within the caucus. His staff was very well liked. But I think it really hit home that it can happen to anyone. And they all just, you know, they want to go home and campaign. That's where they want to be now.
All right. Well, we will look for them out on the trail. Heather, thank you so much for joining us to talk us through this.
Thank you.
And Gloria, thank you as well.
Thank you, guys.
And Charlie, thank you for being here in the studio.
Thanks. It was wonderful to be here with you.
It was wonderful to be with you, Charlie. All right, as promised, we are going to turn things over briefly to one Nerdcast superfan to take us through the credits at the end of the show this week. Yang from Zhengzhou in China is going to help us out with another intercontinental edition of the Nerdcast credits this week.
Nerdcast is produced by Makila Rodriguez with help from Adrian Hurst. Dave Shaw is the executive producer, and their illustrator is Bill Cookman. If you like Nerdcast and you're listening on Apple Podcasts, rate the show and leave a review. It helps new listeners find the show.
Thank you, Yang. Listeners, we found Yang because he emailed in to say he was a fan. If you are a fan of the Nerdcast who wants to read the credits, let us know. Please shoot an email to nerdcast@politico.com. Thank you so much for listening. We will talk to you again next week.
What about, he's dead too?
Who?
Rusty the bailiff. You don't remember Rusty will have some papers for you to sign out back?
Right. I totally forgot.
Not that I watched too many episodes of that. And agreed to have their dispute settled here in our forum.